Welcome to Speaking of Business, conversations with Canadian innovators, entrepreneurs, and business leaders. I'm Goldie Hyder, President and CEO of the Business Council of Canada. Today, I'm speaking with Jeff Smith, CEO of construction juggernaut Ellis Don. The company's projects include Rogers Centre, the Art Gallery of Ontario, and countless other public and private facilities across the country. I'm sure you've seen their signs. Our fascinating conversation covers succession, disruption, politics, and how Jeff and his team brought the company back from the brink with an employee-driven, values-based strategy. Enjoy. Well, Jeff, thanks for doing this. Really good to see you.
Pleasure to see you.
Where do we begin with a company like Ellis Don? You know, it's a sign that people see all across Canada. What is Ellis Don? Who is Ellis Don?
Well, first of all, it's a company with very big signs.
Yes, clearly.
You know, it's just a bunch of people. And I mean that in the most sincere way that I can. We don't have any exclusive intellectual property. We don't know things that other people don't know. A lot of people think, well, there must be some big brain trust there. We're really just a group of people trying to do our best. That's the way I describe ourselves to the employees, actually, especially after we screw something up. It's a team of people who love building and who love business.
And was that love for building something that was always in you, given the fact that this is a family business? It started with your father and your uncle. Or is it the kind of thing where you said, I'm not going to do that?
Well, so first of all, you notice I added, and who love business, because I'm actually not a builder and I don't particularly love the details and engineering of construction. And everybody who works at Ellis Don knows that. I love the business of Ellis Don. I love doing deals. I love, and I think people who work here know this too, I love and respect the kind of people who work here. So I love what I do for a living. They also know that I can't build anything. I couldn't build, a house with a deck of cards.
You weren't very good with Lego, were you?
Terrible. And a Meccano. Everybody goes, everybody has Meccano. I never had a Meccano set, never wanted one. When I walk onto a job site, people are worried I'm going to hurt myself. But most other people here obviously love building. The accountants here love accounting, and the lawyers here love lawyering, even though we don't have too many lawyers. We've got some really good ones. So it's about loving what you do, whatever it is. Clearly, most people love building.
How do you make up for that gap? Obviously, you need to have some passion for the construction industry, for infrastructure, and for building. It can't just be doing deals all day long.
No, listen, I mean it when I say, and I mean no disrespect to all the lawyers I used to hang out with earlier in my career, but construction people are the best people. You can still do deals in construction on a handshake and on a napkin with your clients, with your subcontractors, and with your employees. Every day is different, and every day is a different challenge. So if you enjoy people and working with people and doing something different every day, you're going to love this business. And the people at Ellis Don, I don't think, well, most of them stay here a long time, mind that gap with me. They just accept that I can't do what they can do.
Let's talk about your journey here, because it wasn't a straight line.
No, it was a pretty crooked line.
Take us through that.
Well, so I was never going to join the family business, like never. And you'll probably ask me about my dad in a little while, and I'll explain why, much as I loved him. I wasn't sure. I thought I'd go into business because I actually thought I'd be pretty good at it. I also thought I could change the world and be a great litigator and maybe be Clarence Darrow or somebody like that. So I was torn, and eventually I went to law school, got me further away from the family business, thank goodness. They offered me, the firm that I articled with, offered me a job doing matrimonial law, which I thought was the worst thing ever. And still,
speaking of construction.
Yeah, still think that. Yeah, if you want violence and swearing, matrimonial law is a good place to start. So I didn't take that job. I thought, well, I'll go into corporate law. And I did that for literally less than a year. And what I found is that I'm not very good at that. And I think I'm not very good at that because I think I have attention deficit issues. I mean that seriously. Like, I can't get through a shareholders agreement. I can't sit through a meeting where other people are negotiating terms and I'm expected to write them down and capture them all. So after about a year, I said, okay, this isn't working. I got to go back into litigation somehow. But I thought I'd go into business. The reason I joined the family business that I had sworn I would never do is that the great thing about Ellis Don from the beginning, and this came obviously 100% from my father, one of the only pure entrepreneurs I've met in my entire life, was he would throw all sorts of responsibility at you really quickly. So if you wanted to get into it fast at a young age, still in your 20s, that was the place to go. It wasn't the place to stay because it was too much upheaval all the time, but it was a great place to start. So I said, okay, let's go.
Now, the Don and Ellis, Don is your dad.
That's right.
And Ellis is your dad's older brother.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And do you think you're more like your uncle than your dad?
No, I'm not like my uncle at all, much as I loved him. And he was my godfather, but he was an engineer and he was a straightforward construction person and a very logical. He was a good builder, not a great business person. So I don't think I'm like him. And I don't think I'm very much like my father either. So there you go.
My father's my hero. And my father started a business as well. And I swore I'd never go into the family business. And sure enough, I did for a period of time. And a lot of it had to do with me and less so to do with him. But I'm curious, your father was a larger than life figure in Ontario and Ontario politics and in the business community. And please don't take this the wrong way. And I say this with great respect to him is there was a bit of Donald Trump in him. You know, there's a stories about how he was just an aggressive businessman. And if, you know, he would walk onto a site and if he didn't think you were up to the job, I think his words weren't quite, you're fired, but you're out with a thumb, you know?
No, that's exactly. Yeah. You've done your homework. When I was 10 years old, here's a story. Or I think I was probably 12. A friend of mine whose father was in the development construction business in London, Ontario. And he said, your father will walk onto a job site and fire everybody on the job site. And I said, you know, I'm 12. I'm pretty much on top of things, right? I said, well, that's just stupid. Nobody would ever do that. That's crazy. Makes no sense. So anyway, I went home that night and said, I just heard this story that you'll walk onto a job and fire everybody on the site. And he said, sometimes you got to shake things up. Like, who does that? Well, my dad does that.
Right. And it worked for him.
You know, it worked for him to a point. So you would go to work, as I said a few minutes ago, to Ellis Don, and you would work there for 2 or 3 years. You'd be young and you get lots of great training. And then you would either quit or you would get fired. And mostly you would get fired. He would bring you up. He would put you in over your head and then he would fire you. He got a lot of great energy and a lot of great work out of a lot of very young people. And he did some really terrific things like build Skydome, now Rogers Center. We'll get to that. But I also think it really limited his growth. I think he lost a lot of really good people that frankly went to our competitors that built great companies on their own. So it worked and it didn't always work.
And is that why you take the approach that you do now?
You said a minute ago, Goldie, that your father was your hero. I got along for the most part, except when I didn't. I got along mostly in my life well with my father, and I learned a great deal from him. He used to say to me when we were fighting, and we'll get to that probably, you'll never make it in construction. You're too much like your mother. In other words, you're a mama's boy. And I would say to him, I'll wear that badge proudly. My mother was my hero. My mother was a thinker. She was calm. She was extremely intelligent. She was very active in the community. She was very people-oriented. She used to make me stop and think more than anybody else ever did. So my mother was my
hero.
Six siblings, seven of us. Yeah.
Seven of you. And how many are in or were in the business?
At one point, there were six of the seven in the business. Only my eldest sister, Kathy, managed to fully escape the clutches. She got all the brains. At one point, there were six of us. As of right now, there's only two.
Now, you had a period in which you left the company.
That's right.
Take us through that experience.
So listen, at home, it was a big, raucous family. It was lots of fun. My parents were both working very hard. They were rarely there. There were seven of us. We had a blast. When my dad was there, he was terrific. I had a great home life. At work, once I got into a position of authority, I ran the Western Canadian operations for a while, and then I was president, chief operating officer. Not so good.
Why?
He's a very strong-willed sort of a guy, and he wants to be in control, and it's his company. Me, I was a bit immature, I'm sure, maybe a lot, coming up very ambitious, wanting to take over and take the reins. So I don't think I was thoughtful enough about what he wanted and what he needed. And I don't think, frankly, he was thoughtful enough about what I wanted and what I needed to enable us to work together. So we fought like the Dickens. And it was a tough time. It was the early 90s. All of our clients went broke. Like, they all went broke. Bramley, Trizec, ONY, et cetera. So it was a tough time, and we were just fighting. So finally, I was 40, and he was 70, and I said, well, one of us has got to go. And he said, well, that won't be me. So I said, oh, okay, well then.
I guess it's me.
I guess it's me. So in the summer when I was turning 40 years old, I left. I just walked out.
And then you came back.
And then a year later, I came back. And the
what
company.
Happened?
What happened was the fellow that he put in my place, that didn't work out so well.
Non-family member.
A non-family member. And then that guy tried to buy the company from Don. He thought he could put together the financing to do it. And he had a deal, and it was all set up to close in late summer 1996. And at the last second, the deal fell through. He didn't have the financing. He couldn't do it. He and my father were obviously not getting along. And so there was a family friend, a good friend of my dad's, had been helping him through this whole process, called me up and said, you got to come back. And I can tell you, it was a very stressful period, both on my own home front and on all fronts. But I went back.
And how did it work the second go around? What did you do differently, for example? You know, Linda Hasenfrantz tells a great story from Linamar about how she has, with her father, a posted agreement of four things that, you know, that he's going to do and everything else she gets to do. And every time he intervenes, she pulls out the post-it. Do you have a post-it that you used? Or
no,
how did you
here's
go
how it worked at Ellis Don. I'm good for Linda. I wasn't able to get that far. My dad, as we said earlier, is too much larger than life. He was too much the guy. And I said, I'll come back, but he's got to go. So he retires. He's out of the building. He doesn't get to come back in the building. And I will come back.
How do you feel about that deep down?
It was the only way it was going to work. I don't feel bad about it at all because the company was on the verge of failure at that point, or was maybe 6 months out, but it was coming.
Situationally or because of him?
Partly it had been a very tough time. But partly it hadn't been well managed. A lot of good people have been chased away. We had this resort in the Caribbean, which was busy sucking all our cash out, partly because of me. I expanded in the U.S. before I left. That was a losing operation. So I don't want to duck my own responsibility here. I definitely had some. And as I said before, the fight was two people fighting. Nobody's innocent. So I don't want to, I'm not going to blame him, but I'm not going to give him any credit either. He was the CEO. But no, I don't have any regrets to come back to that. That was literally the only way we could do it. Did it cause some bitterness? Yes, it did for a while. But my brothers and sisters and I all had to go to the bank and borrow money personally. There wasn't a lot of money around. So that meant our houses were on the line and they backed me. They realized that if you're going to make a change, there had to be a change.
Was it hard to shake the legacy? Did you find that people were still doing the comparison or, you know, your dad wouldn't have done it that way? How did you deal with that?
I honestly didn't worry that much about that because for the first 2 years, we were just trying to stay in business. So the legacy that was hard to shake was the reputation that Ellis Don was too tough, too hard a company. Our clients, especially in Ontario, didn't like us. The subcontractors didn't like us. We had this leadership gap that was causing all sorts of confusion in the marketplace. So for the first 2 years, it was just about trying to save the company. I used to say, when you come back from lunch and your desk is on fire, you don't need to worry too much about setting your priorities. We had a cash flow crisis, like we were out of cash. And I was trying to keep the employees from leaving. Our competitors were trying to steal all our good employees. So there was a lot to worry about other than that.
Well, I think it's safe to say your mom would have been very proud of you or is very proud of you. It's your dad?
By the end, and let me say a year or two or three passed, once the company really started to turn around, he and I started to get along a lot better.
Did he ever say to you, Jeff, I'm proud of you?
He said it to me, and he said it, more importantly, he said it to a lot of other people.
Yeah. That says a lot, given his character and what he's been described as.
It does say a lot for him, and my dad was nothing if not an honest guy, so at least when he was saying bad things about you, you knew he meant it. When he was saying good things about you, you knew he meant it. So it did mean a lot.
Well, that's good. Good to hear. Thank you for sharing that with us. I think it's important that people know what makes you who you are, and part of it is that journey. So let's talk about leadership. Let's talk about leadership and what you think leadership is and what makes for a good leader.
So I come by my views on leadership honestly as we've described. I don't know anything about construction. I have to tell you a quick story that's one of the most important things for me. After about 2 years, when we knew the company wasn't going to go broke, after I'd come back, and I finally had a chance to sit back and think about things, one of the things I realized was that none of the really core people at Ellis Don, none of the people that the company needed if it was going to survive, had left. So you have to ask yourself, why didn't they leave? And I was under no illusions that it was because Don or I had provided great leadership. We had done the opposite because the place was a mess for a while. So what do you do? So I went around and I asked them. I said, why didn't you leave? Just tell me the truth. And most of them didn't tell me the truth, but one fella did. A guy named Rick Magicomo. He said, Jeff, we all talked about it. We all thought about it. And what we decided was, remember, these were people who had been here a long time, that we liked working together. We decided we could save the company, and we decided that's what we were going to do, so that's what we did. In other words, and Rick's a very modest guy, they just decided on their own that the company was worth saving and that they would save it, and they did. So for me, I laughed and said, do you think you might want to, like, let me in on this? And we laughed, and we're still friends. He's retired now. But then I realized those guys were leading every bit as much. They were guys, much. We have more women now, but back then guys. They were the leaders. So my theory of leadership is, which I get from stuff you read too, the Jim Collins, I'm a fan, is just get great people around you, find a way to attract them and keep them, and then get out of their way. And then the company will go where it's going to go. And frankly, I don't really care where the company goes. I care that we have great people who have a great time, who have great values, who love working together, and who can do it. So with me, we talk all the time around here about leadership is being humble, leadership is being determined, but leadership is about getting out of the way and letting somebody else lead. And for them, they have to get out of the way and let somebody else lead. So that's my view of leadership.
Are you able to do that because you're a private company?
I have no idea, Goldie, because I've never worked for a public company. In fact,
the reason I'm asking is, I mean, the public companies seem to be driven by the investor calls and the quarterly reporting. And part of leadership is long-term thinking and a vision about where we're going. Do you have the advantage as a private company?
I think you have a terrific advantage as a private company.
Have you thought about going public?
No, for two reasons. One is exactly that. I actually couldn't tell you what my quarterly earnings are. I have a hard enough time figuring out what my annual earnings are. When you've got, frankly, $5 billion worth of buildings under construction, how much did you make yesterday? I don't know. Nobody knows, quite frankly. So to be away from all that quarterly reporting and short-term thinking is a huge advantage. We can focus. We have a strong independent board. We can focus on what needs focusing on, which is the short-term but also the long-term. And the other reasons, you go public because you need capital, either for growth or liquidity events like succession, et cetera. We don't have those in construction. It's a self-financing business. You grow as big as you want. Conventionally, you don't need capital. So we're good.
Good. Now, disruption is everywhere. I suspect it's not escaping the construction industry either. How are you managing disruption in your business, and what does it look like?
Well, to me, it looks like we've done a pretty good job of escaping it up till now. And for sure, we are not going to be able to escape it any longer. It's coming at us in all its fronts. Construction is being digitized. Construction is largely a leadership process. Every part of it, plus manufacturing, plus everything. Not only is our business model as a company being turned inside out or about to be, I think the whole industry business model is breaking down or is about to break down. I don't think it'll look at all in 5 years what it looks like for the last 50. So everything we're doing now is about getting ready for that disruption, given that we do not know exactly what it will look like, how exactly it will play out. We don't have a clue. But the thing about construction that's certainly coming our way is that Silicon Valley sees a great opportunity in the construction industry because we've been so inefficient. So they are coming at us hard. They also want our data. So they're giving us the software cheap, partly so they can get in and take control of our core businesses, and partly so they can get our data. I intend to give them at Ellis Don neither control of our core functions or our data. How exactly we'll accomplish that
to be seen
is to be seen, but we are thinking about it very hard.
But in some ways, isn't that what the business community, and small or large, is really facing today is, I remember it once being said that all businesses are on the journey of becoming IT companies, irrespective of what you're selling.
And you and I have both heard people say that if you're not turning yourself into a software company, you will be out of business. And I buy that 100%. So there is a battle going on in many industries, and the battle is just being taken up in construction, where the software companies want to put the legacy companies out of business, and the legacy companies, such as Ellis Don, are trying to turn themselves into software companies so that they don't get put out of business. How does a legacy company turn itself into a software company? Well, as I said, it's not that difficult. The software isn't that hard to do. I believe that the key to our survival is our willingness to take complete risk over the entire process, which the software companies won't do. So we have a survival strategy. We'll see how it plays out.
One of the advantages I have in this position is to go across the country and meet with CEOs from all kinds of different sectors. And I ask them what keeps them up at night. What keeps you up at night?
So what else keeps me up at night other than the software business, right? Really, two things. One is, I'm more worried now than I've been in 20 years about the state of the world. We have not been, you know, from a purely economic basis, we haven't had a recession in our industry for 20 years. And in construction, recessions are killers. They hit us harder than they hit more. We do better in booms than most companies, but we do worse in recessions. And the longer we go without a recession, I fear, I stay awake at night thinking the deep it's going to be. And therefore, the much worse it's going to be for us. So that is killing me. But then now you look out and you see the world almost throwing itself into bad times. I don't need to tell you the whole trade and tariffs and Brexit. And this whole business of just let's polarize the whole world so that it's all them and us, whether you're talking about economic or racial or any other grounds, you know, that just doesn't lead to recession. That can lead to war. Like, I don't think I'm being alarmist.
History shows it does.
You know, history shows it does. And we seem to be headed that way blindly and in a hurry. And I spend a lot of time not sleeping over those things. And then there's just the whole thing about what don't I know? I'm trying to find things to worry about. So I find it's a scary time right now.
You've got kids. I've got kids. Is this a generational thing to some extent? Do you have more hope that some of the things you just described of the world steamrolling into this direction, a course correction can take place with generational change and generational leadership change?
Well, I don't know about that. I worry, frankly, that we've just come through, like the period before the First World War, 60 years of peace and prosperity. And I think maybe we've forgotten how dangerous things could be. I tell my kids that for my entire life, I could never understand how Hitler was elected, because he was elected at the beginning. Now, in the last 3 years, I figured out how Hitler managed to get elected. So do I see the kids as the salvation? I sure hope so. But I don't think it's obvious.
Well, we brought the subject of family into this. Let's talk a little bit about yours. How do you find how you're going about, you know, and raising your kids versus how, you know, your parents had to raise you and your six brothers and sisters? Is it easy? Is it harder?
It's different. My dad always said that we were ruining our children because we were watching over them far too carefully. He had seven kids and let us go. He was a disciplinarian,
don't
get me wrong.
Something to be said for that, by the way.
No, there's a lot to be said for it. I tell my kids I had a much better childhood than you did. Because as we all know, the baby boomers helicopter over their parents and over their kids, and watch them far too closely. So is it different? It's different. Is it better or worse? I don't actually think it's better or worse.
But you have hope for them and
I have terrific hope. I'm a short-term warrior, but a long-term. Things will be fine. They'll figure it out. We'll figure out the environment. I believe that. We may go through some grief before we do, but we will. And the power of technology to make people's lives better is terrific, and we all know we're healthier and living longer, all of that stuff. So I'm an optimist, but we're only going to see that great day if we worry a lot right now. I think the kids today are just fine. I don't think they're better or worse than we were. I think it'll be good.
Now, your dad was known for making it home for dinner.
I wouldn't. Who told you that?
What I read about him says he made it home for dinner.
Yeah, he probably said that. I never.
Do you make it home for dinner, irrespective of whether he did
or not? When my kids were growing up, and my dad was generally home for dinner, and he was generally home for dinner more than I was, I'll give him that. Some of those dinners might have been a little calmer if he wasn't home for dinner. But
let it go, Jeff.
Let it go. I'm just kidding. But I also don't think that if you ask my kids, everybody says, well, when they die, they wish they'd spent more time with their kids. Well, maybe, but their kids didn't really want to spend all that much more time with you. And I think my wife and I have figured out that balance. She wouldn't necessarily agree with me, so luckily she's not here. But I think we got that balance not too bad. I get along with my kids.
Now, are any of them interested in the business?
Well, three of them work. There's three of them, and they all work at Ellis-Don, which was not their goal or mine. Different company now than it was, so different things. The company is growing. We've actually learned to embrace nepotism. The kids of all of our employees, not just me, the Smith family, we now encourage the kids of our employees
stability.
To work here. We find that if you've got the kind of values that it takes to work here, then your kids probably do. We also find that you're probably not going to come here and make your parent look stupid because they will kill you. So we have great experience with our kids. And I finally said, well, to my kids, you know, there's some great opportunities here. But I did say to them, come if you like the business. Do not come because you're my kid or because, you know, this is some kind of family company because it's going to be owned by the employees. So if you like your job, if you like the opportunity, come. If you think you're coming because of some familial issue, that would be a huge mistake.
You've, you know, been very candid about your relationship with your father.
Yes.
How would they describe their relationship with you?
I don't know. Actually, I think you'd have to ask them. I literally, sincerely don't know the answer to that question. I think that they would say that I'm an okay guy. I hope that, because we rarely fight. I think if you said, well, what was the downside? They'd say, well, the nights he did make it home for dinner, he wasn't there all the time. They used to say, I'd be sitting at dinner thinking, and they'd say, earth to dad, yeah. Earth to dad. So I wasn't always the most engaged as I should have been. I was a bit distracted. But other than that, I don't think they have real complaints.
What advice do you give them now? Just in life, not just in business.
Listen, the advice I give them is do not take relationships for granted. Because I think when I came out, I was too ambitious. I was too much in a hurry. I don't think I stepped on people, but I don't think I was always the most considerate person. I think if you're a nice person and you build up relationships and you are honest with people and you got to work hard, all that stuff, the world will unfold for you.
I'm really glad you said that, because in one of your blogs on your website, the company's website, I was surprised because it's more philosophical and reflective than people might expect coming from the CEO of a major organization and a construction company. And a little while ago, you were writing about how you make important decisions and about how, you know, you as a leader are going to treat people, and how too often people are treated based on mistaken assumptions and motivations. What prompted you to write that?
Well, the conviction that people, and by that I mean me and you, we think we know what the other person is thinking because we're so smart. We've got it all figured out. So we then, it's not that we want to offend you or even take advantage of you. We don't, for the most part. But we still think we know what you're thinking when we don't, for the most part. And I tripped over that issue about the Cuban Missile Crisis, where both of the leaders, Khrushchev and Kennedy, completely, they didn't underestimate or overestimate the other. They misunderstood one another because they didn't figure it out, and the world almost ended. Now, you as an individual are not going to make the world end, but you could make your world end if you don't really take the time to try and figure out what makes the other person tick, what is the other person afraid of. And the way to figure it out, I give this speech to every new employee at Ellis-Don, is you just ask them. They may not tell you the first time, but sooner or later they'll tell you.
Right.
And if you can take care of that, they'll take care of us. We'll take care of each other. It is not a zero-sum game.
Now, you've also written a few times, maybe one too many times for me not to pick it up, but you talk about succession. You talk about what's next. So what is next?
For Ellis-Don, you mean?
And for you, both.
Well, my my wife asked me this question.
We're not breaking any news here, are we?
No, my wife asked me this question a year or so ago. She said, how does this all end?
Yeah.
Which is a very profound question. And her point was, okay, Jeff, we've been working for 30 years. We've gone through a lot of grief. We've kind of come out the other side. You're still working 60, 70 hours a week.
Let's enjoy this a little.
Yeah, can we not enjoy this a little? So we're trying to make some changes based on that. But I did say to her, I don't think I can quit working. I get intellectual stimulation out of it, and I'm no good when I'm just lying around the house. But I have said to the people around here, the younger, the kids I call them, although they're now in their 40s, I will not get in your way. So you tell me if I'm getting in your way. So we've got a real succession going on around here over the next year. I'm going to step out of the day-to-day. I want to keep working on the really interesting strategic stuff. We talked about software specifically. As much to let the company grow and let all the young people here do their thing and keep from getting divorced, like there's a lot of upside here for me personally. And I think that's what's next. But I don't think that means I have to leave. I've said if I could hang around, that would be cool.
Well, that allows me to talk a little bit about what it takes to build a culture in a company. How do you even just do change management while trying to maintain a culture? Because you had to do that once yourself, and now you might have to see it happen after you. What advice do you have in terms of the transition? And, you know, you said earlier to the kids, I'm assuming you meant to the next generation.
Yeah, the 40-year-olds here, all the great team we've built. So here's what I'd say. You actually said a couple of things, because maintaining culture and change management aren't exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe that the culture needs to be changed in your place of business, place of whatever, then you need to go in and change it. And you don't need to wait for a lot of consensus. That would be a huge mistake. You need to move fast. You need to be crystal clear. And you need to repeat it to everybody in the world, because they will never believe you the first 10 times you say it. And then you need to live through the moments of truth. Somebody taught me this lesson. When one of the great superintendents who you really need contravenes these new values, what are you going to do? Because if you don't fire that person, your values are done, right? So that kind of change in culture, we did ours around values, excuse me. So that's how those two tie together, are really important. It's the same with change management. Do not wait for consensus. Don't try and build it up. Explain the reasons. Listen to people. Think about it. Make the decision. Go hard, because it's going to take twice as long as you think it's going to take anyway. Now, sorry, but around when I leave here, I obviously don't believe there needs to be a big change, because we worked very hard to build up what we've got here.
But situations changed. I mean, you look at the advent of social digital
media.
And
once I go, I've done everything I can. And if they want to change it, they'll change it all. But we are going to try to make sure that the values stay. Not that the strategy stays. Not that the core business stays. Not that anything else stays. And we talk about values from the time you get to Ellis Don till the time you leave. We never stop. And the next leader, if I have a say, and I will obviously have some say, will exemplify those values and come from within. We all know you can kill values with one memo. And then I do think it's important for that leader, me in this case, to then vamoose in terms of the real leadership. To just really, really, really get out of the way, physically and in every other way.
Well, speaking of vamoosing, as you say, you mentioned that you might look to the day where you are stepping away. And that'll create some spare time. How do you intend to spend it?
I intend to spend it largely the way and I mean this seriously, I need to spend a few years kind of doing what Megan, my wife, wants me to do. I think that will involve some traveling.
You owe her?
Sorry?
You owe her?
Yeah, I think that I owe her. I think she sacrificed a lot for me and for this company. And I think that I owe her, and I'm going to try and repay that debt. I'll have some negotiating position, but I'm not going to pretend I have a lot. Hopefully we'll get to do some cool stuff that I like to do too.
There's a deal you can't make, eh, Jeff?
Yeah, there are. But I'll tell you what, I'll send you postcards from the edge.
I'll look forward to it. Now, your dad, sorry to keep coming back to him, but he was not only a very successful businessman, he was deeply ingrained in politics. Here in Ontario, the president of the Liberal Party at one point helped get David Peterson elected premier.
As was my mother, of course. She was
and your
in
mom, of Peter, course, was
she
a
was in David Peterson's cabinet.
She was in cabinet.
Right.
Is politics in your blood? It's in your blood, but is it in your calling?
It's too late for me. I'm 63, and I'm not going to walk out of here tomorrow. So it's just plain too late. It would have been, you know, it's one of those intellectual challenges. Everybody thinks, could I be good at it? I'm not spared that kind of ego thinking. But no, it's not in my future. But I think some kind of political involvement is in my future. I have to be a little nonpartisan because the government of Ontario is my biggest client. But I think I need to, from my own sense of self-worth almost, to get back involved in some of these issues you and I were talking about earlier. It's time to be worried about something bigger than Ellis Don and to see if I can be of assistance.
Is that worry Canada's place in a very complicated world?
Well, I think that Canada will always be a middle power in a complicated world. I do not, this is just me yapping now, I do not believe that this Trump issue is going to last forever. I think we'll always be part of the American orbit and that situation will rectify itself.
You really believe this is just about him and not about something bigger?
I did say I was an optimist, so maybe a certain naivety is part of that. Right?
Well, that's why I'm pushing you, because I think too often people say, this is just a phenomenon of Donald Trump. And I say, really? Like, this is happening globally.
Let me try to answer the question a little better then. What I would like to do is get more involved in some of the bigger issues to make sure that Canada has its act together, to make sure that we don't lose the values that have made us a great, compromising, middle-of-the-road, tolerant, I guess is a better word that I'm looking for, nation. If we keep that uniqueness, and it's under threat now, and I think both from the frankly, both sides of the political spectrum, they're both playing the politics of division. They need to stop that. If we can get Canada straight, then our place in the world will figure itself out. And so if I can help just stop that polarization in Canada, even a tiny little bit, I don't want to sound too grandiose here, but I think that needs doing, and I'd like to help with that.
Well, you must have thought of some of these issues in terms of what are the low-hanging fruit from a public policy perspective that would help put us on the right path.
I think there needs to be a more reasoned dialogue with society, and I think a smart political leader could do this, to say, what can we afford, because we can't afford to bankrupt the public purse, but what do we need to continue to be a progressive and liberal, small l, of course, nation? And let's have a discussion. Is it pharma? Is it 100% pharma? Is it all these big ticket items, or is it some of them? But I think if you engage Canadians in the discussion around the trade-offs and the values behind them, you can have a great discussion and build the country at the same time, rather than saying, I'm a right-wing person, blah, you know, et cetera, all the flawless matter, or I'm over here on the other side, and you have this battle. I believe Canadians are middle of the road. I think we got to find our way there. And as somebody said to me a little while ago, nobody ever gets passionate about the middle of the road. Well, somebody needs to.
Well, Ellis Don has certainly done its part for Canada. You know, you look at the buildings that I think our listeners would certainly have known of, if not been to, the National Gallery of Canada, the Calgary City Hall, the Halifax Central Library, Rogers Centre, Sky Dome when it was done. We've got the Heart Institute in Edmonton, urban projects in Toronto, and in transit-wise, Toronto, Edmonton, Ottawa. What are the things you're most proud of, and what can we look forward to, even in your remaining time here, as footprints that you're going to leave behind?
I'm proud of the fact as a company on behalf of the people that work here that we did a lot of cutting edge things. We leapt into those public-private partnerships when a lot of people ran away from them and did it in a very innovative way where we did the equity side and the facility management side, not just the construction. And I'm really proud of the courage and the accomplishment it took there, because a lot of great hospitals and courthouses and LRTs are getting built because of that. I'm very proud of the fact that, frankly, that the company survived, partly because it survived in itself, but partly because I do think we have created and are striving to create a really great place to work. And I think that gives the company more purpose for me than the buildings themselves. Those are the two things I'm proudest of.
And so if there's a, not that you're going anywhere anytime soon, but is there a legacy that you most want to be known for?
The legacy is a company that is different from the others, if I can be idealistic here, that cares more about its employees than anything else and trusts its employees to build a great company, and where the earnings per share falls out of that rather than the other way around. I think there's a different way to do business. I idealize that Ellis Don can be an example of that kind of business, and that's the legacy I'd like to leave.
So here you are, very successful CEO, looking at, you know, perhaps transitioning out and pulling back a little bit. But every day you get up excited, coming to work still. A lot of energy, a lot of passion. What drives you?
I don't actually know.
Are you out to prove something?
I don't actually know. Do I have too big an ego? I don't actually know. I can tell you this. They talk about whether leaders are born or made. I'm a firm believer that leaders can be made and different circumstances develop and identify different kinds of leaders. But I've always thought that entrepreneurialism, you're probably either born with or you're not. I can tell you I had two hard-driving parents, two very accomplished parents. I'm sure that drove me. But I was kind of always like this. I was always a little bit too intense for my age and not fun-loving enough for my age. And I think I was born this way, for better or worse.
How did that impact your relationships with your buds?
Well, the truth is I've always had a few very good friends, but I was a long way from the coolest person in high school. Like, I was in the lower quartile I think people liked me, but I wasn't exactly a football quarterback status.
You know what's interesting to me is how many leaders I have met who are introverts. Is that how you describe yourself?
Well, most of us have done the Myers-Briggs test.
Yeah.
I'm right on the line. I could spend a weekend by myself without any problem in a few books. But I'm quite happy to be out. But I can't be out for very long before I need to go back and slow down and think and regroup. So I've got some introverted tendencies for sure. And I enjoy them. I wouldn't give them up.
Well, look, before we wrap, we have a bit of a ritual on these podcasts. We play a little word game at the end. I say a word and you tell me what comes to your mind right away.
I really stink at this.
So we'll do that. And again, Jeff, thank you for doing this. And
my pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot.
Your sincerity and honesty. I think the listeners will benefit enormously from your wisdom. All right, here we go. Leadership.
Get out of the way.
Okay, that's more than one word, but fine, we'll play along.
Too bad.
Infrastructure.
The future.
Politics.
In need of repair.
Family.
Love.
Canada.
Great values.
Jeff, great to see you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much, Goldie.
Thanks again to Jeff Smith for being my guest on this episode of Speaking of Business. Subscribe now for more conversations with Canada's top innovators, entrepreneurs, and business leaders. Search Speaking of Business wherever you find podcasts or visit speakingofbiz.ca to join our email list and follow us on social media. Until next time, I'm Goldie Hyder.